It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Gene manipulation by scientists has been taking place for a while now. One Pitt professor has made a breakthrough in this area. I'm joined now in Studio A by Pitt chemist Alexander Deiters. He created a new light-activated tool for gene editing. We'll discover how it works and what it means for the future of gene research. Alexander Deiters, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good morning, Paul.
Why do scientists want to edit genes? Let's start with that.
Yeah, so gene editing has been around for a while, and the overall idea is that you can use it as a research tool if you want to learn how a gene or a protein functions. You would, for example, deactivate that gene in a cell or in an organism, and one way to do that is by using gene editing and, for example, cutting the entire gene out or introducing mutations into the gene in order to silence it. And then you could look what is the effect that has on the organism and then draw conclusions on the function of that gene.
And scientists have used a tool called a clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, also known as CRISPR. What is the CRISPR gene editing system?
So CRISPR, using CRISPR for gene editing is a very young technology. It's about 2 years old. And it has just revolutionized gene editing. Before, if you wanted to silence a gene for a research purpose or maybe a therapeutic purpose because you want to silence a gene that, for example, causes cancer, you had to do a lot of engineering of proteins to target certain regions of the genome, to cut that gene out, to introduce mutations, things like that. CRISPR is different. CRISPR basically is based on an adaptive immune response that bacteria have. And it basically protects bacteria from viral infection. And it uses a protein called Cas9, although there are many other proteins involved in this as well. But, you know, Cas9 is the most prominent one for gene editing. And it uses an RNA molecule called a guide RNA that targets Cas9 to the sequence of the genome where you want to introduce a cut, a mutation, a deletion. So you don't need to engineer any proteins. You just have to dial in the sequence of the gene that you want to target into your guide RNA, and then you you can silence a gene there. We can activate something.
And how did you engineer a light-activated CRISPR system?
So what we did is we thought it would be great if we could basically have higher control, higher precision over the CRISPR gene editing. More specifically, we wanted to achieve spatial and temporal control. We wanted to go in and irradiate a certain cell at a certain time point and activate gene editing only in that environment. And what we do is we engineer cells with an expanded genetic code. We basically expand genetic code of human cells. All human cells basically have 20 amino acids available to them. And we expand genetic code of those cells to 21 amino acids. And the 21st amino acid that we incorporate into proteins is a light-activatable amino acid. It basically blocks function of the protein when installed in, for example, Cas9, you know, the essential part of the CRISPR system, until it is irradiated with light. And you can sort of compare that to if you want to prevent, you know, your kids from running up the stairs, you put a baby gate up and it, you know, blocks the function of your stairs.
Sure.
And light would remove that. And that's sort of what we do. We basically express these proteins, highly engineered proteins like Cas9, to be non-functional until we remove that block through light irradiation. And we typically use UV light for this to activate those proteins.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Pitt chemist Alexander Deiters, who's created a new light-activated tool for gene editing. Why control protein function and gene editing with light? Why is that the most efficient way to do that?
Yeah, it's maybe not the most efficient way, but it's, you know, it gives you higher precision. You can now go in, if you want to study the function of a gene and the development of an organism at a certain time point, for example, you want to deactivate that gene at that particular time point. Can't do that with, you know, traditional CRISPR technology. With our tool now, you can use light to activate CRISPR at a certain time and silence that gene. Or from a, you know, sort of therapeutic context, if you want to treat a disease with gene editing, for example, let's say cystic fibrosis, you know, you may just want to activate that gene editing tool, CRISPR-Cas9, in the lung. You don't want to have any off-target manipulation of your genome in other parts of your body. So you could basically deliver CRISPR-Cas9 and then only irradiate the inside of your lung and only treat those cells then for, you know, cystic fibrosis, introduce a correcting mutation.
So the purpose of much of this, if I'm understanding you correctly, is the idea of anything that you inherit through genes being passed down from generation to generation, particularly when it comes to a disease or some kind of condition, that you can rework the genes to free somebody from the ill effects of that. Is there a chance that some unscrupulous scientists or entities could get a hold of this and use what you've created for something, if not sinister, just bizarre?
That's a good question. And maybe not so much what we created, because we sort of adapted the existing
sure.
CRISPR system to achieve optical control. But CRISPR all by itself makes gene editing so simple and easy now that as you said, more or less everyone can do this now. And who knows what their motivations are. For example, just in April, we had a publication come out where a group manipulated human embryos, and they tried to... they tried to cure a congenital defect, and they actually found that it's not as easy as expected. They saw a lot of these off-target manipulations of the genome to a point where they basically said it's premature right now to use CRISPR-Cas9 for editing embryos, basically. But that's a very specific area, right? I mean, you would basically edit the germline of a human being, and that human being has a permanently altered genome, and all, you know, his or her offspring will have that manipulation as well. But, you know, if you use it as a gene editing tool in adults, for example, who have cancer, you know, I think that's a very different game now, and fully justifiable there. But this publication where they manipulated human embryos certainly got a lot of attention, and people were not quite happy about that.
People were questioning the ethics of
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, yeah.
What are the next steps? Where do you see this going in the future?
So for us, again, using light as a tool to manipulate protein function, gene function, CRISPR-Cas9, we basically want to, you know, make this into a very nice high precision research tool. So we've done all our experiments so far in human cells and human cell culture. We want to take them into animals, for example, and see if we can, you know, activate or deactivate a gene in a developing animal to learn more about development, to learn more about birth defects. And then also what we're using UV light right now for activation. It would be great to shift that wavelength into for example, visible light, or maybe even IR light, because the advantage of IR light is it has a much deeper penetration depth. You can activate gene editing in deeper areas of the tissue using IR light compared to UV light.
In the long run, this is going to make treating diseases easier?
Not necessarily easier. Maybe the whole CRISPR-Cas9 system will make treating or opens up fundamentally new opportunities for treating diseases. What we did is, you know, achieve light control over gene editing, and that will make this whole process more precise potentially, where you can go in and only activate your gene editing in your disease tissue, only in the tumor where you want to basically cut out a cancer gene, and not in other areas of the body. So you don't, you may be able to minimize these off-target effects of CRISPR-Cas9 that have caused issues before in model organisms and in cells.
And so that you would perhaps be able to avoid bombarding somebody with radiation, for example, if you can focus on a more precise area?
Well, maybe not so much radiation, but more the activity of the gene editing tool. You know, it is a very, very, you know, it's a sequence-specific tool. You only target the gene that you want to manipulate based on the sequence of your guide RNA. But they're always, you know, nothing is 100% perfect. So you always have effects onto other genes, and that is certainly not desirable. And if you have that systemic in your entire body, that could cause significant problems. But if you could limit that to certain locations, like cancer, for example, cancerous cells, cancerous tissue, or to certain time points, you may be able to minimize these off-target effects using light as a trigger for gene editing.
It's fascinating. Pit chemist Alexander Deiters has been our guest. He's found a way to control the gene editing process with higher precision. Alexander Deiters, thank you for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the story of the first African Americans in the space program. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The opening narration of Star Trek refers to outer space as the final frontier. In many ways, space was also the frontier in which segregation met its match. While NASA's primary mission was to go to the moon in the 1960s, one of the residual benefits of the space race was that black engineers, scientists, and computer programmers were hired to fill many of the 200,000 new jobs, thus integrating the Southern federal workforce. But things didn't always go smoothly. The struggles endured by the space program's first African-American employees and their stories are told in a new book called We Could Not Fail. I'm joined now by phone from Washington by the book's co-author, Richard Paul. Richard Paul, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so, so much for having me on the show. It's always great to talk about this history, which until now we thought wasn't there, and now we know that it is. So thank you so much for having me on to talk about it.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002 with your comments or questions. 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Richard Paul, this story goes back half a century. Why do you suppose it's taken so long for it to finally be told?
I think that when historians talk about the space race, they tend to talk about it in three ways. It's either the story of the Cold War, the Russians and Americans fighting for dominance in this one venue, or it's a technology story, or it's a story about great men, you know, Neil Armstrong and Wernher von Braun and, you know, the engineers who achieved this incredible feat. But I think people are now coming to realize that there are also these smaller stories, either stories about impacts off the base or, in the case of this story, impacts on the base and off the base. So I think that's one reason. Another reason is because African-American history is embarrassing for America at large to talk about, I think. It's hard to think about American exceptionalism when you talk about things like Jim Crow and slavery. Same thing with the Trail of Tears and many other things that America did that we don't like to talk about, I think.
Who was it that saw an opportunity here, not only to hire qualified African-American engineers, scientists, and computer programmers to help NASA to mount this massive effort to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade of the 60s, which was how President Kennedy articulated it. He made it very clear that was the goal, and we've got roughly a decade to do it. So who thought of this as, or viewed it, and certainly President Kennedy was one of them, as an opportunity to not only achieve this momentous scientific feat, but at the same time challenge segregation in the South?
Well, in the book, we credit Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was the first person to exploit Sputnik. Yeah, we have this story now 50 years later that, you know, Sputnik went up and we all got scared. What happened was Sputnik went up and Lyndon Johnson made us all get scared. And the reason why was he thought that the space program was a terrific opportunity to change the South by changing the economy of the South. He was looking for a jobs program that Republicans would support, and he knew that the space program was one that he could cloak in the mantle of the Cold War. And so it was a jobs program unlike the jobs programs that President Roosevelt had done in the 1930s. He wanted to take the space race and place its facilities in the South to move the South away from an economy based on farming and towards an economy based on technology and knowledge. And he firmly believed that if he could change the economy, he would get rid of racism, because he thought that the two things were related.
Right, and this was an economy that for hundreds of years hadn't changed and was based on slave labor, and though it wasn't technically slavery between the end of the Civil War and the 1960s, you had oppressed minorities who were doing a lot of the work under oppressive and segregated and unequal conditions.
Well, honestly, not just oppressed minorities. There were oppressed whites as well. The situation in the South, the economic situation, was just dreadful. Less money was spent on education, fewer protections were given for worker rights, because, we didn't have a global society, we didn't have a global economy back then, and so you could pay people and treat people however, whatever you wanted. And Lyndon Johnson felt that a heavy-handed federal presence in the South could change all of that.
Because certainly President Johnson had and is credited with, as historians will point out, an idealistic view of things, but wasn't something he could just will to happen. And you mentioned Sputnik earlier, which we probably shouldn't take for granted necessarily that people know exactly what Sputnik is. It was a small Russian satellite. And explain, Richard, why this scared people and why this kind of jump-started a new mindset in America to catch up scientifically with the Russians, how this competition fueled things.
Sure. I mean, the word was put out after Sputnik that America was falling behind the Soviet Union in terms of science, education, and numbers of scientists that we had. And one of the results of Sputnik going up was the passage of the Elementary and Secondary Education Acts, which put a lot more emphasis on science education. So for white kids in the United States, it meant a lot more science education and therefore a lot more scientists. So that was one of the drivers of this. But the most important connection, I think, is a sequence of events that happened right after President Kennedy was elected. Really, over the course of about 6 weeks in 1961, civil rights and the space program came together. And I can talk to you about this. Series of things happened. April 12th, Yuri Gagarin becomes the first human being in space, Soviet cosmonaut, and now the Russians have won this important victory. 8 days later is the Bay of Pigs, where American-backed rebels are defeated and a Soviet ally is now 90 miles off of Florida. Right after the Bay of Pigs, President Kennedy calls up Vice President Johnson, who is the head of the Space Council, and says, come up with something fast in space, because outer space is going to be this Hail Mary pass that diverts everybody's attention away from Cuba. So May 5th, Alan Shepard becomes the first American in space. 9 days after that, the Freedom Rides start. That's where 7 black and 6 white young people get in a bus in Washington, D.C., with whites in the back and blacks in the front, and they drive down south. May 24th, the bus is firebombed in Anniston, Alabama. The next day, President Kennedy commits to put America on the moon by the end of the decade. A week later, mobs riot in Montgomery, Alabama, around the bus, and the governor declares martial law. So now President Kennedy, who never mentioned civil rights and never mentioned space during the campaign, is thrown in with both feet into the space race and civil rights. And as you mentioned in your introduction, NASA, over the course of the next 10 years, was going to add more than 200,000 new jobs. And Kennedy chose to focus on federal hiring and federal contractor hiring. The contractors and the federal agencies had to put non-discrimination clauses into their contracts. So now the heavy-handed federal government could force people to hire African-Americans. Because NASA was doing so much hiring, it gets completely caught up in this.
So African-Americans are hired to fill, and these are qualified, educated engineers, scientists, computer programmers, and they are going
to... I'll give you one more category.
Sure.
Because you say computer programmers. This is actually pre-computers. And there were people, large number of the African Americans who were the first ones in the space program, were people whose job title actually was computer. What these people did was a lot of the mathematical calculations that your computer does inside the box. These people were doing it by hand with paper and pencil and slide rules and big clunky adding machines. These were people with mathematics degrees and science degrees from black colleges throughout the South, and a lot of them were hired as computers to do a lot of the math that was required to figure out how to put a rocket into space.
So what were the conditions like in the beginning for these workers of color going into the Deep South? Some of them perhaps were based there, but I'm sure they came from other parts of the country, and they're working these new jobs in Alabama and Florida and Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, and they are helping the U.S. embark on this bold outer space frontier, and yet back on Earth, so little has changed, particularly in the South.
That's right. So Julius Montgomery, who we profile in the book, is one of the best examples of this. He goes to work at Cape Canaveral, which for those of us of a certain age think of as the place where the rockets lifted off for the moon. It was sort of the embodiment of tomorrow. Well, he came to work at Cape Canaveral in the mid-1950s, which was a time when the Ku Klux Klan controlled that part of eastern Florida. The sheriff of Orange County was a Klansman. City commissioners and aldermen and county commissioners were in the Klan. One of the people we talked to in the book said local businessmen joined the Klan almost like they were joining the Rotary Club. So Julius Montgomery, all alone, there's no lawyers with him, there's no reporters with him. He's one man. He walks all alone to his first day on the job, opens up the door, and there is a room full of angry white men, many of whom he probably knew were in the Ku Klux Klan. He walks up to each one of them and tries to shake their hand. He said nobody would shake his hand. He tells the story. He said, I got to the last man, and I said, hello, I'm Julius Montgomery. And he says, boy, that's no way to talk to a white man. And Julius says, oh, and I looked at him, and I said, oh, excuse me, oh, great white bastard, what should I call you? And he says, and he laughed, and I laughed, and he shook my hand, which is an amazing, amazing story. If you think about the guts that it took for this man all by himself, you were more likely to be lynched as a black man in that part of Florida than in any other place where NASA was located in the South. I mean, what nerve this man had to go up and use humor to try and defuse this situation. That truly is just the best example of what these workplaces were often like. I can tell you another story if you'd like, or you can ask me a different question.
No, I would like to hear more about some of the key characters involved in this, but I would like to remind our listeners or tell anybody who's just tuning in that you're listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. We are talking with Richard Paul, co-author of a book called We Could Not Fail, which chronicles the struggles endured by the space program's first African-American employees, many of whom went down to the Deep South to work in jobs that eventually resulted in putting a U.S. man and men on the moon, but also was under the circumstances in which they endured racism and all sorts of trials and tribulations. And I'm guessing that in addition to the situation that you just described, Richard, there were also there had to have been some challenges as far as accommodations, as far as going and out and having meals. These folks had to sustain themselves. What was it like for them just to do the ordinary day-to-day things that we take for granted?
Well, and it goes even farther than that. I mean, Clyde Foster, who worked as a computer for many, many years at NASA, and wanted to advance. I mean, he wanted a raise. He wanted to become a supervisor. He wanted to do all of the things that you do when you've got a job and you stay in a job for a long time. And he wanted to advance. And so he asked his supervisor, how do I advance? And the supervisor said, well, NASA offers advanced training classes. You need to take those classes. So he went to try and sign up for the classes, and he learned that NASA only held the classes in the white university, where blacks were not allowed, and in the ballrooms of hotels, where blacks were not allowed. So Clyde, wanting to advance, drove from Alabama to Georgia on a regular basis to take advanced training classes. Slept in flea bag hotels because those were the only hotels that blacks were allowed to stay in. And, he got tired of it. He's got a young family back home. He's got to work. And so he worked very, very hard and over time got NASA to create a separate but equal advanced training program where they brought in professors from black colleges, and they took sent them to the black college in Huntsville, Alabama, and the black employees were able to go to the black college and take advanced training classes. It's outrageous, and it's sort of an amazing thing that this was how Clyde had to do it. I mean, NASA was not going to integrate this, but they said, well, if you want to create a separate program for the Negro employees, you're perfectly free to do that. He's sort of amazing. He not only did that, but he also, after a while, at a time when NASA was trying to find more African-American employees, he said, you know, why don't you lend me to the black college? I'm going to start a computer class over there. He started the first BA degree in computer science at a college in Alabama. He started it at the black college, Alabama A&M, and he graduated all of these young people who now had computer skills, who went to work at NASA. They were some of the first computer programmers at NASA, but it was Clyde Foster who did this. He also went on to become one of the first black mayors in the South when he learned that the little enclave where he lived outside the gates of the Marshall Space Flight Center had once been a town back in the 19th century, and he got the town reinstated as a town and got himself appointed mayor. They appointed a black city council. He appointed one of the first black sheriffs in the South and started the Eastern Conference of Black Mayors. This one NASA employee, his is an absolutely amazing story.
We're talking with Richard Paul. He's co-author of the book We Could Not Fail, which tells the story of the first African-Americans in the space program working for NASA in the deep South in the early 1960s. If you have a comment or a question, 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Richard, how well did the black and white engineers get along?
Well, it depends on where. In Alabama, Morgan Watson, who along with five other young men became the first African American engineers at NASA when the space program opened up its college co-op program to students at black colleges, they came in very early 1964. And when they got there, nobody would rent them a room. Nobody would rent them an apartment. And they got housing in the black community. There was a recruiter who got them work. And Morgan said that on the job site, everything was equal. But when they walked off the base, everything was segregated. He told a story about going to a Ray Charles concert with the guys, and there was a rope right down the middle of the auditorium with the whites on one side and the blacks on the other side. And, you know, the real trouble became when they left Huntsville. He said, you know, the way we used to put it was, when you leave Huntsville, you're in Alabama. And he tells this story about one night they were coming back from something on a Saturday night, wanted to get something to eat, and stopped at the bus station. And the colored side of the lunch counter was closed, and they tried to get some hamburgers, and the waitress told them, hey, colored side's closed, get out. And these guys, you know, they're NASA engineers. They're big shots. They're in the press. They're working for NASA, and they decided they weren't going to take it anymore and got into the waitress and the manager's face. Waitress said, I'm going to call the police. And the guys knew what this meant because right at the time that this was happening, there were some young men who had disappeared in Philadelphia, Mississippi, who were later determined by the FBI to have been murdered by people from the sheriff's office. So when she said, I'm going to call the police, they jumped in their cars and got out of there because they knew when you get outside of Huntsville, you're in Alabama. So that was life off the base. But on the base, they did find that people worked well together, though George Borda, who was one of the other co-ops, the way he put it to me, he said, I'm very light-skinned, I look white. And he said that he could hide, essentially, with the white co-ops and hear what people really thought. And they constantly thought, oh, I don't think they can make it. I don't think they can cut it. But the guy showed that they could come in every day, do the work just as well as anybody else. And one of the things that we say in the book is that in doing that, in proving that, they had a civil rights victory that was just as great as anybody who marched or sat in.
Some NASA officials apparently relished pushing for civil rights and tangling with George Wallace, including NASA's Administrator James Webb and, of all people, the ex-Nazi rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, who were based in Huntsville. Talk about how these men in particular stuck their necks out to push back against the governor of Alabama at that time, George Wallace, and the people who identified with him and identified with that attitude.
That's right. And it should be to remind everybody under a particular age that George Wallace was the one who, at his swearing in, said, you know, segregation now, segregation forever. And he was the governor of Alabama. And so NASA tried in a number of different ways. The two highest profile ones, right around the time of the presidential election where Johnson ran against Goldwater, there were hints that were dropped that NASA might move out of Alabama if Alabama didn't do more to improve its image with regard to race. And it caused a real uproar in Huntsville. There were business people who sent telegrams to the White House saying, how can you do this? You're going to destroy our community. And they kept at it. He gave a number of press events where he dropped hints, and the black press just ran with this. There were also those who saw it as a political ploy. Lyndon Johnson was not on the ballot in Alabama when he ran for president. The Alabama Democratic Party kept Johnson off the ballot, and there were a lot of people in the Republican Party who said, oh, this is just the president taking revenge on Alabama, either saying he's going to move NASA out of here or actually taking NASA out of here. And NASA did not end up moving, but that was one time that they took on George Wallace. Another time, George Wallace ran for president very briefly in 1964 and was thinking about doing it again in 1968. And he liked to attach himself to NASA. And he was touring Alabama with a group of small-town newspaper editors, but also people from Time Magazine, New York Times, Washington Post, tagged along also just to see what George Wallace was telling these people. The purpose of this tour was to show them the real Alabama, was what he said. And he took them to NASA, and James Webb and Wernher von Braun learned that he was coming ahead of time and turned the tables on Wallace. What they did was they decided, all right, we're going to make this a big event. They penned everybody in, all the reporters. Wallace showed up with most of the Alabama legislature for this trip. They penned everybody in and said, hey, big surprise, we're going to show you a test of the Saturn V rocket. Now, a rocket test is like a rocket launch, except the rocket just stays there. So you've got the countdown and the noise and everything like that. They penned them in. They watch this rocket test, and then while all the reporters are there, von Braun and Webb come in and lecture Wallace and the legislators about how Alabama needs to do better to become part of the 20th century and do better, especially on race, and it made national news. They took George Wallace out of the front page by turning the tables on him and using NASA and its prestige and the Saturn V rocket to turn the tables on Wallace in this event.
Wow. And so how did Wallace react? Did he get the message that, I may not change my attitude about this, but I'm going to have to figure out some way to go along politically or else we're going to lose a huge industry here?
Well, one thing we know is he never came back to NASA for a visit. I mean, that was the last time he came back. You know, there are a lot of reasons that other historians have pointed to about why and when George Wallace changed his mind and whether he ever actually felt the way that he spoke early on, whether he was just doing it for political expediency. There are a lot of people that have looked into this a lot more deeply than I have that have ideas about why George Wallace did what he did. You know, Alabama today is not the place that it was in the 1960s, and there are a lot of people who credit NASA with that.
How did the space program change the South?
Well, not as well as it wanted to. According to Morgan Watson, who I mentioned was NASA's first black engineer, he said that it helped to break the walls down, that it changed people's opinions of black people in the South by showing that there were engineers and technicians and scientists who could handle this work. They showed that black people could do it. You have to remember where society was at the beginning of the space program. There were many whites who felt that African Americans were not human, they were subhuman. And to have black engineers, black technicians, black mathematicians going to work every day, doing this work, doing it as well as anybody else. This is why Morgan Watson said we could not fail, which is where we got the title of the book. He said we felt that the entire image of black people was riding on us as professionals, and we could not fail. If one of these people messed up at work, it was not, oh, Julius doesn't know how to do this, or, oh, Morgan doesn't know how to do this. It was, those people can't handle it. And so by coming to work every day and doing their work as outstandingly as they did, as I said earlier, they had a civil rights victory that was just as great as all the other civil rights victories that we read about in our history books.
And there was a tremendous amount of pressure on these African-American engineers, I guess much in the same way that other African-American pioneers in other fields, like a Jackie Robinson, for example. I mean, all the weight was on his shoulders to prove that an African-American could make it in the major leagues. This sounds like the same type of thing, only with engineers and scientists and computers and computer programmers.
Yep, that's right. I mean, you know, and honestly, a journeyman first baseman could not have been the first African-American in Major League Baseball. Jackie Robinson had to be the best. And it was the same with George Carruthers, who built the first telescope that human beings ever placed on another planetary body. It was the same with Frank Crosley, who patented titanium-based alloys that were used in the skins of rockets. You know, it was the same with Julius Montgomery. It was the same with Clyde Foster. It was the same with Morgan Watson. These people had to be the very, very best. And they were. And they were the pioneers who kicked the doors down and created the space for people like Guy Bluford, who became the first black astronaut, Mae Jemison, who became the first African-American woman in space, and Charles Bolden, who is now the administrator of NASA, NASA's first African-American administrator.
And the story is well documented in your book, We Could Not Fail. Your book certainly gives credit where credit is due. But from the broader standpoint of history, have African-Americans, the people that you've described in your book, who were a part of the formative years of NASA, have they been given the credit for what came after? Certainly the first orbit around the moon, the first man on the moon, the subsequent Apollo missions, and all that came after.
Have the African American employees gotten? Have they been given the? No, I mean it's one of the reasons why we wrote this book. I mean, my co-author Stephen Moss, when he first started researching this back in the 1990s, he was a graduate student, and his graduate advisor said, "If there was a story here, somebody would have written it already." But Stephen persisted and said, no, there's something here. There's got to be something here. And we went through and spent the time and the years and made the phone calls and did the research to demonstrate that there actually was a story there. And it is the first time that these people are, as a group, are getting the recognition that they deserve. There were certainly articles in the black press about a lot of them at the time. Frank Crosley had articles written about him. Clyde Foster had a wonderful profile that was done in Ebony Magazine about him. Morgan Watson and the other co-op students were celebrities in the black press and in the black community when they first went to NASA in Alabama. But as far as the broader society is concerned, these people have not gotten the recognition that they deserve. And it's one of the reasons that we wrote this book. And the nice thing is that a number of them are still alive. And it's wonderful that they're going to be able to get the recognition while they can still appreciate it.
The book is We Could Not Fail, and we've been talking with the co-author, Richard Paul. It's a book that documents the struggles endured by the space program's first African-American employees. Richard Paul has joined us by phone from Washington. Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to join us and share this story with us.
Well, thank you so very, very much for asking. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, what punishment fits the Deflategate crime of Tom Brady? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A penalty reportedly will soon be handed down to Super Bowl-winning quarterback Tom Brady of the New England Patriots for his involvement in Deflategate, the incident in which the National Football League says Brady at least had some knowledge that the Patriots' equipment men were letting some air out of footballs, thus making them easier for Brady to throw. That's illegal, by the way. It happened in their Super Bowl qualifying victory over the Indianapolis Colts. So should you take the championship away? How should you punish a cheater like Tom Brady and a team like the Patriots who have done this cheating, that is, on more than one occasion? Joining us to consider these questions is Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus Bob Dvorak. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Paul. Good to be here.
So we're hearing that the decision that the NFL is not going to wait terribly long on this, that they're going to announce some sort of penalty for Tom Brady. And as a longtime sports writer, sports observer, what do you think should happen here?
Well, I wouldn't lowball Roger Goodell, I'll tell you that. This is an image-driven industry, and anything that impacts the image of the National Football League, they take very seriously. I mean, the number one thing in the NFL has always been protect the shield, protect the image, protect the brand. And I really do think that there'll be some sort of fine and or suspension as a result of this.
What is an appropriate penalty here? You know, if they're going to – Le'Veon Bell, the running back for the Steelers, for example, was caught with possession of marijuana – and he was given a suspended sentence. He's not going to serve any time. He has to do some community service, I believe. But the NFL is saying, we're not going to let you off. We're going to suspend you for 3 games. So if you can get a suspension for something like that, what does something like this that compromises the integrity of the sport, what is that worth?
Well, yeah, that's a good point, Paul, because, illegal drugs, steroid use, or even the Ray Rice affair, that kind of stuff merited pretty big penalties. But if you really do mess with the integrity of the game and you tamper with the rules that apply to everybody else, I think it might be a bit stiffer. I know the Patriots are actually making contingency plans that he may be suspended for a year.
Wow, now that would be something. Now, is this really such a bad thing? I mean, there's a rule apparently, and you can explain this about that the football has to be inflated to a certain point, and if quarterbacks may want to let air out. In this case, Tom Brady supposedly could throw the football easier if they did, and apparently they did do that. So, but aren't players always looking for an edge? Don't teams cheat? Haven't they cheated forever? I mean, why is this such a big deal?
Well, there's the rule is that football has to have a minimum of 12.5 pounds per square inch of air. Anything lower than that might give you an edge on gripping the ball, whether you fumble it less or throw it better in the rain, I'm not sure. But, you're right. From the time of the first human sports competition, people have been looking for an edge. And it's one thing to brush up against the rules. It's another thing to cross the line and do, if you're bringing bad publicity on the NFL, and, if you look at this report, and it's obviously written by lawyers because of the probables and the general knowledge and that sort of thing. But if you cross the line and get caught, then you're going to pay a penalty.
So is it more about that you're doing something that's, you know, adversely affecting in the court of public opinion our billion-dollar industry? Is it more about that than the actual act of the cheating?
Well, yeah, I would think, you know, if you look at the championship game where these deflated balls were used in the first half, it was a pretty competitive game. In the second half, when the balls were inflated properly, New England made it into a rout. And, of course,
the Ravens
tipped off the Colts about this, so apparently it's happened before. And I don't think it was so much the act of cheating itself, but the intent was there. And then the credibility issue comes up because Tom Brady said he didn't even know one of these gentlemen that was involved. And if you look at the text messages and everything else, some of the rewards for their services were autographed jerseys and shoes and memorabilia that are worth a lot of money. So
that were given to the equipment assistants.
Yes.
Okay. You know, you don't want to compare this to Watergate, but they, as with so many other things, they put the gate at the end of it. So we might as well invoke the old, the lie and the cover up is worse than the crime. Is that part of what's going on here?
Well, yeah, and I would, yeah, I am loath to compare it to a political scandal that brought down the president of the United States. You know, I don't see a crime committed here. Tom Brady didn't harm anybody, but I do believe that it's the cover up and the credibility issue is always worse than the crime.
So the problem here that a lot of people have with this is they say this is what helped the Patriots go on to the Super Bowl. Obviously, they can't win the Super Bowl if they don't get to the Super Bowl, and this is the game that got them to the Super Bowl. So, you know, if this was the NCAA, they'd be looking at taking the championship away. If this is about cheating to win a championship, why isn't the NFL looking at taking the championship away?
Well, I think they will take a look at it, but, you know, you'd have to really prove it. There'd have to be, solid evidence that that it impacted the outcome of the game. And, of course, we know in the Super Bowl they coddled those footballs pretty well to make sure that everything was in order. So, and then you'd have to go back and say, well, did it impact that game or this game or whatever game? And then it becomes very problematic. So I don't think that's a case at all. And the thing is, you know, Paul, when you look at it, you know, I'm no Tom Brady fan, but just what he's done puts him in the upper echelon of quarterbacks who ever played the game. And, you know, he doesn't have to cheat. He doesn't have to bend the rules. If you ask me what this does to his legacy, I think it really takes the air out of it.
What does it do for the legacies of teams that haven't cheated? I mean, the people, because the Patriots have won, you know, 4 Super Bowls, the Steelers have won 6. Some people have said, well, maybe the Patriots are the greatest team of all time. If they cheated and somebody like the Steelers didn't, or at least it hasn't been proven that they did, does that make the Steeler dynasty better in 30 seconds or less?
Yes, or Green Bay, or those teams that abide by the rules. I mean, nobody goes around talking about Johnny Unitas' balls or Terry Bradshaw's balls, but from now and forever, they're going to talk about Tom Brady and these footballs.
Well, we all know that the Steelers have won more Super Bowls than anybody else, and at least for now, until or unless anything ever comes out, we can comfort ourselves with the fact that our dynasty is the best because we didn't cheat. Bob, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and thank you so much, as always.
Well, I'm going to go have a highball right now, Paul.
Okay. You do that. Bob, that's what you get when you're sports writer emeritus for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Bob, again, thank you. Bob Dvorak, our sports guy. Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.